You're listening to Distraction Therapy with Rob Watson. Conversations about how we find meaning in our lives and what it's like to be part of a meta-modern world. Hello, it is, let me just check the date, it's the 30th, Friday the 30th of December, and this is the last Distraction Therapy podcast for 2022, and I'm here with Ryan Clayton.
Hello.
And we're going to just, I don't know, but we've just been actually, we've had a long extended conversation where we've covered loads of really good stuff, but we're not going to refer to any of that. We're going to try and think of new things to talk about, and plus we've both got a new coffee in, so we're in our usual coffee shop in Market Street in Leicester. We're in 200 degrees. How's your Christmas going? I always think people say, have you had a nice Christmas? Like, how long is this supposed to last? Like one day? Yeah. Or as well, it's like a week, 2 weeks of stuff, isn't
it? Well, it started late for me because I didn't finish work until about the 23rd. So by the time I got off, that's when it started to feel like Christmas was on that Friday. Because I thought, you know what, let's make it feel like Christmas. Me and my friend, we finished at about 3 o'clock, which was earlier than usual. And we thought, let's make it feel like Christmas. Let's go to Foss Park on the 23rd of December. And it was vile, Rob. It was just filled with people.
The busiest shopping day of the year.
I know, and it was both brilliant and ridiculous. You couldn't move for people. The car park was like so full that nobody was moving anywhere. So even if you found a spot, you had to wait 20 minutes to get the 5 meters to get into it because the cars weren't moving. And then once you got in and you walk around all of the shops, you realise that they're all a bit naff.
Well, this is the equivalent. Oh, you know, make it feel like Christmas. We'll go for a vanilla latte with loads of cream and top, you know, marshmallows shoved on the top of it. What makes that feel like Christmas? What would you describe as making it feel like Christmas?
The misery.
You look forward to that.
It was very festive, the misery. Because all I really did there was, you know,
went. But what's different? What makes it seasonal and Christmassy? Because the misery is constant.
That's a good question. Other than the fact that it was cold, I can't really tell you. What was funny was going into Menkind, because, you know, that shop's, it's always a little busy. There's like dribs and drabs of people in there, but around Christmas, it's a sight to behold. Considering it's filled with tat and tat alone, the queue was all the way back to the door. And I don't know why.
Well, because everybody's there trying to purchase something at the last moment.
Purchase something shit.
Yeah, basically. And I mean, that Menkind, it sells things like action figures and remote controlled swords and all sorts of stuff that comes out of, I mean, who designs these things out of factories? It appeals to a certain imagination, but it's like, oh, I'll get somebody as a gift. And then what do you do with it? It's that Christmas thing of buy people useless stuff because it's, well, this will entertain them for a bit. It's like, you know, kind of cups with a funny message on about, you know, some kind of sexual innuendo on it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, I loved the cups in particular when I was doing my office Christmas party. The amount of people that opened up their Secret Santa present to reveal a mug that had a somewhat
offensive message on it. Yeah.
Well, the worst thing was it's not that everybody's a bit too, you know, they've got a bit of a stick up their ass, so none of them are particularly like funny or rude. They're just sort of, oh yeah, that's amusing, but it won't be when I'm drinking my coffee out of it for the second time and I see it and I'm like, oh yeah.
Well, look, there'll be a bin somewhere with all these cups in them, yeah. And it's like, you know, you walk around city centres and shopping centres, and the shops are full of things which are just they're useless. It's like they're either, you know, there's a trend in the UK for card shops to be full of offensive messages, and it's like can't I just buy something? I usually make my own Christmas card, but I usually end up, and usually they are offensive. This year it wasn't for some reason, but you have to go to somewhere like John Lewis to find a tasteful card, because everywhere else is selling these kind of caricatures of kind of pictures of laughing donkeys on them. That's the one that always annoys me.
I was going to say, I forgot to bring it up, but it warmed my heart, Rob, when your Christmas card came through my door. I didn't even realise you had my address, so it was kind of half, "Oh, that's sweet," and half, "Why has he got my address? This is..."
Well, because I've also got your date of birth, I've got your telephone number, I've got your email address, setting up companies and bank accounts and things. I've got all of those details.
This makes it sound like Rob's a stalker, but I assure you that made it make more sense to me. I was like, actually. He does have all my personal information. That's correct.
Yeah.
It was nice. But I mean, to be fair, I'm never really that. But I got a few Christmas cards this year. One from my granddad. One from you and one from somebody I barely know, and it's always the same. I look at it and open it up. That's really nice. It's from Rob. That's really lovely. It stays on my desk for about a day and then it goes in the recycling.
Yeah.
And then, but I don't know, that's what cards are for, really, is it?
Well, I mean, maybe a bit longer than a day, but it's like, you know,
it touched me for that.
Well, I've always tried to make my own Christmas cards, and some years I'm more inspired than others, and I like the idea of sending something, and I'm rubbish, really really bad at putting a message inside them. You know, you want to say something pithy. And maybe somebody might have collected my Christmas cards over the years, you know, that kind of thing. And there'll be a box of them with 30 years worth of Rob's half-assed Christmas cards in there. However, I just think it's something nice that, you know, it's like, it's the gesture. It's like when I go away on holiday, sending postcards.
Yeah, it's a nice thing to receive. It's a nice little ritual.
And it's also quite expensive. Yeah, first class stamps are like a pound now. Bloody hell, when did that? These used to be 25p, you know, and you could send loads of cards each year. Now it's a pound, so you kind of really, you know, you restrict who you send them to.
Yeah, I mean, well, it may be cynical of me, but I've never bothered with Christmas cards. I've always, like, on Christmas Day, If I get a text, if I get a text that says Merry Christmas, I'll be like,
emoji, a Santa emoji. That's about as.
Yeah, I mean, I hate them, but I'll respond and I'll say, "Oh, yeah, Merry Christmas," but because you know, I feel like if somebody makes that, I feel like I should respond, but it's also, it's Christmas. I don't want to hear from you. Get out of my phone. leave me this one day of the year. Leave me alone. But.
Yeah, and there's plenty of days before then to send people messages. I don't know. I think, is it a case of, I don't know, I mean, changing trends and people becoming kind of, I mean, people are kind of as sentimental as they ever were, if not more so. But it's like, well, you don't need to do the work anymore, so you just send a series of text messages. And it's like, well, I can get text messages from people anytime, but you know, when do you get a card or a postcard off somebody? It's kind of like has a different level of effort that's put into it, I suppose. That's how I view it, but whether it comes across like that, I don't know. So
no,
I just care a little bit more.
Rob, you're better than a lot of people, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to say. I'm virtue signaling, basically.
But no, I think from my point of view, receiving a card, it is a bit special. It is a bit nice. Like when I opened it, I was like, "Oh, Rob sent me." Because it was unexpected as well. I was like, "Oh, Rob sent me a Christmas card." I wasn't even sure Rob liked Christmas. That's nice.
But I'm not sure I like Christmas. Yuletide. I was looking up the spelling of Yuletide just to make sure I get it right, because inevitably I spell these things wrong.
Mm.
And Yuletide predates the Christian celebration of Christmas.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, well, this is a Yuletide message. Kind of Germanic, Northern European kind of celebration of winter. That was a good one. In the past, I've sent Festivus cards, which is that the Seinfeld George Costanza's dad has Festivus for the rest of us, you know, which is great. And but you know, you just kind of go from one to the other. I'm not really serious. I don't mind Happy Christmas. It's fine. I like it.
Yeah, so. I like Christmas, but only really because it's a really good. It's cozy. There's a coziness about Christmas. And about the winter in general, that you don't, but it's most concentrated at Christmas, that you don't really get for the rest of the year. It suddenly becomes not only acceptable, but like the thing that you should be doing, to just sit inside with a candle on or whatever, with a book and read. And people typically, they've gone to a different part of the country or the city to see their family, so nobody's bothering you with their nonsense. You can just sit there and relax.
But I mean, all of this travelling around, it's only recent. You know, it's kind of, people travel on the day before and then coming back. You know, they go on the 24th, travel on the 24th, come back on the 26th. It's actually ridiculous, you know. It's like, stay at home and just sleep for a couple of days.
Well, I know somebody that I work with for Christmas. They decided to spend Christmas with a bunch of their friends in Malta.
Oh, nice.
And I was like, well, all right, it's a different, I've not heard of people, you know, people doing that. I've never known anybody that's done that before. But
you know, if you're just there for 2 days, what's the point? You know, you really need to spend a week.
I think they've spent the whole, so we finished on Friday the 23rd, and we then go back on Wednesday the 3rd, or Tuesday the 3rd, sorry. I think they're there for the whole week. Right. I think they're at Malta.
Because it is, you know, you're right, it's like kind of, it's the winter. And marking, you know, the depths of the winter. You know, when I get to the solstice, you know, there's always a sense of relief that there's a couple of weeks after where the days actually do get a little bit shorter, but then because of the tilt. But then you get to like the second week in January, and you then start to look at the time, and it's like a minute or two every day that it starts to get. And then you're waiting then to get through to March for the spring to come. I said, okay, you got through that cycle, that up and down cycle of, you know, living in the Northern Hemisphere, of following the seasons. But I think you're right. I think one of the challenges that we don't shut things down. I mean, in the United States at the moment, with their snow and cold snap that they have, and you know, things have just got to stop doing things.
Well, I was talking to somebody. I went to a dinner at one of my girlfriend's mate's houses, and she's literally just come back from, I think, DC, where she was staying, and like her flight got cancelled, and she got put on one like last minute, and she was like, oh, if I don't get out now, I'll never get back. But it was like, what was quite interesting about that is, not only does it never stop in America, but none of it stops. She was telling me about how when she's in DC, there's like a shooting every week that just like doesn't really even get reported anymore. So it's so commonplace. And you think even during Christmas, they're gunning each other down over there.
Well, you know.
That's not very festive, is it?
Well, in my neighbourhood, no, somebody...
Not very Dickensian.
Somebody on Marlborough Road was stabbed on Christmas Eve. Somebody was beaten up on Christmas... You know, it's like it just doesn't stop. if anything, it gets worse.
It's a wonderful life, Rob.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. You know, and we're in Pottersville. You know, that's the thing. It's like, you know... And I wonder if that's because... You know, we don't stop things. You know, it's like I came in to meet a friend on Boxing Day who was working, and I said I'd meet him afterwards. Yeah. And we met up, and the town centre was packed with people out shopping on Boxing Day. And it's like, just close everything. You know, I long for the days of the lockdown because things were closed. And it's like, you didn't come in to just wander aimlessly around Primark or TK Maxx and, you know, go to a chicken fast food place or something. It's like, you know, there are more important things. Yeah. Close it for at least 2 days.
Rob, I've never loved more a period in my life than I loved lockdown, Rob. Oh, my God.
Because you didn't have to interact with people.
I didn't leave my house for like a solid 3 months. Yeah. So I just sat there.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And it just, you know, the... the question of, you know, kind of what the let's make it feel more Christmassy, as we started off talking about, was let's go to an out-of-town shopping centre and sit in a traffic jam. It's like, honestly, what possesses us to do that? It's one of the reasons I stopped visiting family at Christmas, was because there was one year, and I was with my sister, and she wanted to go to Costco or something, so we had to drive there from basically Liverpool, and the route that she took for some reason was unbelievably long and out of the way. There was a more direct route, but she's like got no sense of direction, so she ends up going what she thinks is the shorter route, but takes three times as long. It was about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon in December, so it's dark, it was grey, it was, you know, foggy, it was cold, and you're sitting in a car with a load of kids, and it's steamed up, and, you know, it's like you can't, and I thought, I'm never doing this again. It's my idea of hell. You know, it's like sitting there, you're kind of being driven around by something, you've got no control over it because you're a passenger. And it's like, no, and then to go to what? Go to a department store, you know, a shopping centre, and it's like, it's just too depressing. I'd rather sit and do, you know, nothing.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I did it primarily because I knew it would be miserable, and so I went.
It's like an ironic gesture.
Well, it wasn't an ironic gesture. I did it because I thought, do you know what? At least, like, it's something to do, and it'll kill a couple of hours, and then I'll go home. And maybe I'll find a couple of good books. It'll be miserable. It'll be funny. It'll be like, yeah, I guess it is an ironic gesture, really. But I found a copy of A Christmas Carol, and that was the second thing I did over the festive season to make it feel. I was like, because what's more Christmassy than Charles Dickens, right?
A Muppet Christmas Carol. That just adds to it, which is you know, when you said, you know, what makes something feel Christmassy? Well, for me, it's when you feel in the mood for putting a Muppet Christmas Carol on.
So. Do you know, I've never seen it.
I've never watched it. Oh my God.
The only version of that film that I, or that story that I remember, is the one where Patrick Stewart plays Scrooge. And I don't even remember.
Yeah, there's hundreds of them. It's like Albert Finney, Alistair Sim. I'm trying to remember. There's everybody's made one.
The Bill Murray one as well, Scrooged, like modern day retelling. I quite liked that one about 10
it's
years
the Jim
ago.
Jim Carrey one that they did, the animated, the Robert Zemeckis one.
I'd quite like to see that.
I don't see that.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you could make a study of them, write an article about all of these films. But
I don't know.
I mean, The Muppet Christmas Carol's 30 years old.
Wow.
But it's still. We were watching Adam's Family, the Barry Sonnenfeld version, and we were still laughing. That, you know, there's a couple of films from that period which are still funny, and I think you know, Muppet Christmas Carol is still a good film.
Ooh, what was interesting? I'll have to watch that, because I never really liked A Christmas Carol as a story. Maybe it was all of the like adaptations and stuff that I'd seen, but I remember being very unmoved by them. Like
the Plight of Time, Tiny Tim.
Yeah, fuck Tiny Tim. Sorry, probably shouldn't swear on this thing, but no, forget Tiny Tim. But then I read the book, and it was by the end of it, I was weeping, Rob. It was one of the most beautiful things I had ever read. I don't know specifically what it was, but there was a moment when he's visited by the third ghost and he's being seen, you know, the aftermath of his death and how little it even affects people, and how when it does affect people, more often than not, it's pictures of joy, or, you know, there's that one family that it's like, they're not really worried about the fact that he's dead. It's more so, oh my God, what's going to happen to our debt that we had to him? Who's it going to be passed on to? Oh, at least they won't be as horrible as Scrooge. Maybe we can get an extension.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it all plays out. And you've got the burglars that have burgled his deathbed and the curtains off of it and stuff. And then there's a moment in that where, because you know it's him, that, like, you know it's bound to be him, when I just start crying. I think especially after the first ghost visits him, and you get all of those like vignettes of his past and what's led up to this moment to make him the man that he is. I remember feeling very like there's one where he's a school kid and they're all out playing and he's sat there reading and all of these literary characters are walking across the window to show that he's like so in his mind and in these books and isolated from everybody else, and it feels almost inevitable that he would end up like that, the Scrooge figure that has almost become like archetypal by the end of it. And then to have him redeemed at the end when he's then like, he wakes up and says, like, oh, thank God, there's still time. Like, he doesn't want to die alone. He doesn't want to have such a negative impact on the world and the people around him. He finally sees it and reconnects with everybody. And I'm just weeping.
I suppose the message is that you've got to see some value in your fellow human beings.
Yeah.
And if you don't see that, if you're disconnected from that, the value of people, you know, we live in a very cruel world. You know, the people who design out-of-town shopping centres are quite cruel because they're playing on people's, you know, it literally is the same, you know, it's the money collectors, it's harvest time for the money collectors, you know, it's Christmas is that period of, it's hyper-commercialism, it's can we sell as much tat to people as possible and forget about the value of it, forget about the sentiment of it, you know, and it's become so industrialized and it loses its symbolic importance. So, you know, it's a reminder. And I think that's the problem is it's become kind of taken on as a kind of a chocolate box kind of regurgitation of a story, which has lost its mean in itself. Mm. So it's like an affectation, as you say, like an ironic gesture, which is why I think the Muppet Christmas Carol is the best retelling of it, because it is completely upfront with that and it understands what it's doing.
Yeah.
But you know, the central message though is like, you know, don't lose sight of the fact that people are more important than your profits.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that was so interesting for me about reading the book, because I went into it admittedly thinking, like, well, I want to do more reading. I've always wanted to read Charles Dickens. It's Christmas. I'll give it a read. Not expecting to be really moved by it at all or to even encounter a good story, because, you know, I'd had this preconception that it was this boring, like, stuffy old thing. Really,
you ever read, I read Little Dorrit. That's an amazing book. I love that. No. There was a film made in the 80s, which is really good. And, you know, there are some Dickens stories which are kind of, I mean, he was a page turner.
Yeah,
you know, definitely. He was a serial writer, you know, he was kind of, in terms of literary genius, he was...
Well, this is the thing that I found over the past couple of years when I've decided to on and off read more, like, well, not much more, but a little bit more classic literature. Like I told you, I've read The Count of Monte Cristo and slightly more modern Fahrenheit 451 and, well, A Christmas Carol, and now that I'm reading like Lord of the Rings as well. One of the things that struck me as really interesting about all of these books is the way that people talk about them makes them sound very, like, stuffy and boring and overly intellectual and, like, they've got no life in them whatsoever. They're, like, they feel academic when you look at them and you go, I don't know if I want to... Look at the Lord of the Rings is huge. It feels very academic when people talk about it. And it's the same with The Count of Monte Cristo and Fahrenheit 451. And then you read them and you realise that the reason that they're classics, the reason that they have persisted for so long in time is because they're really good fun.
Yeah.
And that's it.
They're really good page turns.
They're really good fun. And I remember reading the preface to Lord of the Rings, where Tolkien's talking about how, you know, people want to confer, like, allegory and meaning onto Lord of the Rings, and whilst he's not denying the fact that it's there, he's saying that it was never his intention to make Lord of the Rings allegorical.
Yeah,
his primary.
Well, he hated C.S. Lewis.
Yeah,
he hated his work. So it was a contrast, which C.S. Lewis was all about trying to make it allegorical. So. Mm.
And what was interesting was that he makes it very plain and very obvious that his primary focus always was to make a really good story that would keep a reader invested for however many pages Lord of the Rings was. He talks about how he really wanted to make a long work, like a work of sustained fiction, that keeps a reader invested from beginning to end.
The other person, I don't know if you caught up with his Dark Materials.
I saw the cruddy film that came out in the early 2000s.
If you go on the iPlayer, you can watch the... Have you ever read the books?
I've never read the books.
Okay, put it on your list then. So the Philip Pullman, again, is one of those people who... Again, I you do this with some books, don't you? But the first 100 pages you find difficult to get into. But then once you've established that world in your imagination, then you just page turners. Yeah. And he's just really good at that serial writing of just what happens next, what happens next. I'm waiting for the third book of Dust to be published, which hopefully should be out soon.
Well, that was what I thought was so brilliant about the sort of 1-2 punch, if you will, of The Hobbit followed by Lord of the Rings, because The Hobbit is very clearly like a more, I don't want to say naive, but it's like, it's easier to get into, isn't it? It's very much like a bit more of a kid's story. And
well, you're not using long elvish names and words for places and looking at complex mythologies. It's like there was a hobbit, he lived under the ground.
It's brilliant. But it's
simple storytelling.
Yeah, and it's brilliant. And one of the great things about it is it acts so well as a primer to that world of Lord of the Rings, that it acts as a brilliant story on its own. You fall in love with Bilbo Baggins and this world and the dwarf, to the point where when some of the dwarves die at the end, I was like genuinely a bit sad. And then you get to Lord of the Rings and you're already invested. You're already there. You already love Bilbo Baggins. You already know some of the stuff that they're referring to. So I slipped into Fellowship of the Ring so seamlessly. It was really interesting.
So tell us then about Avatar, The Way of Water.
Excellent segue, Rob. I hated it. I thought it was boring and unnecessary, and I don't mind long films, right? I'm going to get that out of the way. This isn't like a vendetta I have against sitting down and watching like a 3-hour-long movie. Like, I remember sitting down at university with my friend to watch Satan Tango by Bellatar, which was like 8 hours long, right? And we loved it. It was brilliant. There was no fat on that film whatsoever. Incredible. But the story that Avatar 2 is trying to tell is so slight that I don't even know why it wasn't 30 minutes of a TV show or a short film that then led into whatever story James Cameron wants to tell. Because it is essentially a story of revenge following on from the first Avatar. And I'm going to spoil it because I really don't care. But so what happens is, you know, the main bad guy's consciousness gets put into this Avatar and he then goes out to seek revenge on Jake Sully because he killed him and all his family because he's sadistic.
It's like he's haunted by a ghost.
Exactly. And it takes 3.5 hours to get there, but then eventually they have a fight. And when you think that Jake Sully has killed this evil army person or whatever, suddenly he gets back up and he says, well, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to come back and I'm going to kill him. And Jake Sully is sitting there with the rest of his family. One of his kids gets killed. It's not very sad because I never learned his name. And he said, well, this is it now. We're not going to run away anymore. We're going to stand and we're going to fight. We're going to get them. And it's like, you should have come to this realization 3 hours ago. That should have been the film.
The opening premise.
Yeah, why did I have to sit through what is like an hour of nonsense about like poorly crafted, very obvious allegory about the dangers of whaling? Like, this isn't like 2009 anymore. Like, give me something more than space whales that very obvious evil bad guys are hunting down and killing, and we're supposed to sit there and go, yeah, whaling is bad. It's like being hit over the head constantly with a hammer.
I mean, the interesting thing is it's past $1 billion at the box office, apparently, $1 billion.
Oh my God.
But I just wonder, you don't strike me as being somebody who is part of their target audience, other than gullibility of going to see it for the spectacle.
Yeah, I don't know. Because I remember talking to a couple of my friends, and I'd heard, like, oh, I, you know, one of my friends who I work with said, like, oh, you know what, I didn't want to go see it, but it was really good. I quite liked it. The end fight was a little bit long, but I liked it.
Yeah.
She's an idiot, right?
There are no redeeming qualities.
No, do you know what? No, awful. My brother, who, to be fair, is an idiot, but he'd already watched it, and we went to see it on Christmas Eve.
He saw it again.
He loved it so much, he saw it a second
time.
So
what was it he liked about it?
I've no idea.
Did you not ask him?
I didn't, because do you know what?
By which point you'd given up.
I was so filled with bile and rage and vitriol at the end of having to sit through that movie.
Insulted your intelligence to reach that point?
I'm not even sure that it was just boring. It was the fact that it's like nobody had told James Cameron no.
It's 3 hours of exposition.
It's what it felt like. It's 3 hours of setting up the third film.
Right.
I'm not going to go see the third film now, because honestly, what are they going to do? They're going to have another fight somewhere else on that moon.
There's an interesting thing. I've been watching videos on YouTube just because my concentration span has kind of departed me. And a lot of it is about the way that the Star Wars narratives are being rejigged and redeveloped. And a lot of it's probably kind of clickbait stuff that just pops up as YouTube does.
Mm.
But it's interesting. I've been slowly working through the Clone Wars TV series that George Lucas did prior to departing when he sold it to Disney. And it goes down there's a route that I'm about halfway through in the third season, but there's a route where all of a sudden it introduces this mystical element to the narrative,
mm-hmm.
which was abandoned by Disney. So the sequel films that Disney were supposed to produce, George Lucas's template had the narrative drive of that was a more mystical interpretation, exploring this idea of the Force as being actually generated by these corporeal beings called the Wills.
That's interesting, because then in the prequel films that he made, it becomes more.
Yeah.
The Force becomes more scientific.
Yeah.
So was that supposed to be the plan?
Yeah, it was part of his narrative structure of what he wanted to do. So he's introducing kind of witches, and, you know, it becomes a more fantastical kind of approach. And whereas, you know, the middle part that we see of the story in the original trilogy is much more about, you know, action and function, if you like.
Mm.
And it has these elements wrapped around it, but you don't really know what they are. This was to be an exploration of it in more, you know, the world beyond the world that we see, if you like, which is what Disney abandoned. But it's just the interesting thing that the narrative progressed from function to something beyond function. I'm trying to find the right words for it.
It was just a spectacle, wasn't it?
Yeah. Whereas, and that seems the same trap that Cameron is kind of.
Yeah, I
misunderstanding spectacle for somehow it being meaningful.
Yeah, and it was. And you know what? The spectacle itself of that film, we get it. The special effects, mildly impressive. It's fine. The expressiveness on the characters' faces, brilliant. The way that you're able to render these massive environments, brilliant.
But whereas I'm blown out every time I see Kermit the Frog, which is just a glove puppet.
Exactly.
Far more impressive.
At the end of the day, like, who cares, right, if there's not something genuinely interesting backing it up? I don't want to sit... I could go play a video game that has, like, similar rendered graphics now at this point in time. I could go read a comic book illustrated by somebody with genuine artistic talent and flair.
So what do you think other people are seeing into this that you're not, then?
I don't know. I don't know, to be honest. I think it is... It's the one thing that I will say for it, despite all of its flaws, is it's well put together, at least. Even though I thought it was really boring, there are you sit there and there are parts where you go, Do you know what? That was a nice little sequence there.
Yeah, the craft.
Yeah, the craft of it is good. It's fine.
It should be.
But yeah, it should
given
be.
Its budget and
well, it
and
should
it,
be.
And the time it's taken to
James,
do it.
James Cameron is making this film. He's been in filmmaking for decades now, right? It should be a well put together film. But the problem is there's nothing else to it.
Yeah.
There's.
Well, that was always my complaint with J.J. Abrams. He was an upholsterer.
Yeah.
And what he could do was take something and give it a new, you know, he could replace but he couldn't design the actual structure of the object. All he could do was put the surface texture on it.
And I didn't mind so much. You know, the sequel trilogy of Star Wars. The first one, I didn't mind too much because it was.
I've grown to hate them. Considerably more. I mean, it's like you get sucked into this world of kind of fandom, which I'm not really part of, and it's like really geeking out, but it's just a complete waste of our time and money because you come in on a period. Okay, so you've gone through this period of defeat and evil at the end of the third, you know, the Return of the Jedi, and then what do you do when you go back to the sequel film? You see them back at stage one all over again with nothing in between. You never had this new republic being built. You never saw that, and you never saw the fall of that. You were just somehow supposed to accept that somehow they'd risen. These heroic gestures were empty, meaningless gestures. You just completely undermined all of the films that came before.
Yeah.
And then what you do at the end of it, you resurrect the main ghost when you killed him off. Invent something new. You know, he's dead.
What would have been interesting?
Oh, no, he survived. It's like, bloody hell, you know. It's like, you know, you suddenly discover, and it's ex machina, you know, whatever the phrase is. The Knives Out, the Glass Onion film.
Deus Ex Machina, yeah.
That's the phrase.
God from the
Machine. You pronounce it better than I do. And, you know, and it's like, oh, I'm going to spoil it. Oh, there's a twin sister. Well, that's just really bad storytelling. Oh, the evil genius survived. I mean, we understand it with Moriarty, you know, we understand it with Blofeld because we've got used to that and it's like you expect it. But with these films, it's like these stories, it's like saying, you know, kind of, it's like you kill off Scrooge at the end of the film and you go, no, he doesn't get redeemed.
Well, also, I feel like the main difference between something like, you know, Star Wars...
That would be the Russian version of A Christmas Carol, the Dostoevsky version, wouldn't it? You know, Scrooge is not redeemed, and everybody's lives becomes more miserable, and there is no hope.
I'd read that. I think that would be brilliant.
I'm sure it would stand the test of time.
But, you know, and it's one of the things, it's one of the main problems that I have with like, cinema in general, is when you look at the James Bond films, and it's where the latter Daniel Craig ones went wrong. Those are like self-contained, like explicitly like dumb genre affair that's like, you know, very much like a piece of entertainment, like it's a spy thriller, and you can pick up those films in any order and it really doesn't matter until you get to those Daniel Craig ones.
Well, what did they introduce to that?
It's the
they introduced the fact that you were supposed to care about James Bond. You weren't supposed to ever care about James Bond.
It's not even...
He was a distant iconic character of serves a function of displacement. Like, no, you don't invest in James Bond's inner life, his turmoil. His, you know, it's like, that's not what you... This is a person who goes beyond something that you can care about. You know, you want to be like him, maybe, but you don't want to care for him. You don't want to sit there and make sure that he's... You know, at Christmas he's getting a Christmas card and he feels loved. Mm. But it's not what James Bond's about.
Well, it's also the idea that I really don't think films work very well at telling a story over several films. I mean, there are a few examples where it has worked really well. But then if you look at other examples, it's pretty much been a failure. You look at the Star Wars films over time, because there's years between when these films are released. The first Avatar was brought out in 2009. Why am I supposed to care about these silly little blue people on a moon somewhere?
What, Smurfs? Because they're fun.
Yeah. I think I'd care more about if the Smurfs showed up in the third one. I think that's what would bring me back to watch those movies. Like, oh, the Smurfs are in it. But it's, why is anybody supposed to care? Why is it a continuation? Why couldn't it have been, right, a second film that stands apart, separate from the first one, that is simply set in this, you know, water tribe that James Cameron obviously wanted to explore? Make the story about them trying to stop the whaling from going on because they have this deep connection with the ocean and with the animals within it. Well, then you can already cut 2 hours out of the film and this useless protagonist who's a crap father and just do away with it all. The whole film is supposed to be about, like, revenge and family and these, you know...
It's not The Godfather, though.
Yeah, it's dreadful. And it, the thing that always strikes me as really funny is just how bad of a dad he is. It's really... the way he interacts with his kids, it's like he's interacting with them as if they were soldiers as part of his battalion. And I thought, okay, I can see this coming. He's going to learn.
But it's really facile storytelling like that, isn't it? One-dimensional characters.
Yeah, I thought, like, this is... I could see it coming a mile away. He's going to learn to grow and to accept his family and be more of a dad, but he doesn't. Even when his son's lying on a rock dead. And so it's like, all right, okay.
So you can't identify with the central character?
I can't identify with him. I think he's boring. He's a crap dad. And the only reason you're supposed to care is because, what, 15 years ago a film came out and made a lot of money?
Yeah. I've no intention of seeing it. When it comes on Disney, if I'm still subscribing to Disney at that point, I might sit and watch it in small segments, but I fell asleep during the did I go and see... I didn't see Avatar at the cinema, so I saw it when it was... I saw it on streaming. I think I'd seen bits of it, and it was just one of the most boring films I've ever watched. I fell asleep. I think, and it was the cartoonish... black versus white, blue versus whatever, pink.
Blue versus white, yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, it's just this simple, very crude backwards and forwards.
But do you know what? At least the first Avatar film, right, for all of its faults, at least it told a complete story that had a beginning and a middle, and it ended, right? There was... something was achieved. There was a victory. The plot went somewhere.
Yeah.
What's happened in the second one, I think, because
trying to resurrect it,
because James Cameron's making all of these films at once and he intends them to all be this one massive long saga, nothing's achieved in that second film that relates to the main thrust of the plot of the narrative.
Just the only thought I've got, kind of thing, is something good might come out of it in terms of, I don't know, a new standard of technology to tell stories with or something, but I'm not sure it's...
I'm not even sure that's a good thing, you know. If it's going to make people lazy, like it's clearly made James Cameron lazy, I'd rather not see it.
Well, uninspired.
It's vastly uninspired, but I guess there's always been uninspired, you know, artists and filmmakers that are in it for the money.
Well, Hollywood is, you know, that kind of commercial cinema is entirely about, you know, the Hobbit trilogy compared to the Lord of the Rings trilogy was very much, you know, it functions very well, but it's uninspired in terms of its core emotional resonance.
Well, to be honest, I only ever saw the first Hobbit film, and I can't really remember much of it. And I, as far as the Lord of the Rings films go, I saw the first two and half of the third one. And then, because my friend made me sit down totally unprimed, knowing nothing about Lord of the Rings or the films, because he made me watch the extended editions, by the 2 hours through that third film, I was like, do you know what? I don't care if all of the good stuff is in the latter half of this movie. I no longer care.
Yeah.
And I gave up. And I said, one day I'll read the books, because this seems like something I could get very into. So recently I read The Hobbit.
So brilliant. The hook that you get from literature then, which you are not finding in films, what's that? What's that hook that you're finding that is...
I think at the moment I just haven't... It's not that I'm necessarily more drawn to books or you know, as a...
But you seem to be finding them more satisfying than...
I think it's because I've been watching bad films recently. It's, you know, it's difficult because I spent a lot of... I spent a lot of time when I was at university, and then when I was doing my master's, and after that I was really into film, and I spent a lot of time watching a ton of really good films, and I still really love cinema, like new and old. Like earlier we mentioned Pinocchio. For the flaws that it had, for one, the guy that they, the kid that they got to
the
play
Del Toro
Pinocchio, was a great film, and I loved it. I couldn't get enough of that film. But then you go and see something like Avatar, and it's just like, do you know, why don't I just, because I've not spent a lot of time reading like classic literature that's supposed to be brilliant. Like I've explored film a lot. I've explored and continue to explore like comics, because that's like my like medium of choice, if you will. But like I've sat down and I've read the odd book, but I want to
explore that. It's important, because there's a phrase that kind of popped into my head before Christmas when I was thinking about some other stuff, which is symbolic resonance. I don't know what that means. It's just a phrase that I kind of maybe try and explore a little bit. It's you can have the simplest thing. For example, we are sitting next to a plastic Christmas tree, and it's got coffee cups on it, and it's like kind of, but it's not very good, but it's kind of got some. It still has. It's a symbol of something which still resonates in some way, despite the fact that it's actually a fairly crappy example of a Christmas tree. There's not much thought and effort gone into it. It's not well looked after. It doesn't occupy a. It's just there as a kind of an empty gesture in a way. And that often describes the filmmaking that you're trying to describe, whereas the books that you may be tuning into is that has that something is different about the way that it resonates symbolically, because it's a bit, you know, you approach into that in a different way. Mm. You know, maybe pushing past the kind of cynicism of the commercial mercantile nature of popular cinema kind of means that, you know, when you go back and revisit things, and literature is a really great example of this, that has stood the test of time over generations, that people keep going back to and keep finding meaning in. And if you're looking at something, you go, I don't find anything meaningful or virtuous about these characters depicted in this film. They are just empty avatars of themselves, and there is no redeeming qualities within them. You know, it's that you know, that humanistic dynamic that somebody like Shakespeare has stood the test of time, because he understands what that means to be the human dilemma, and that resonates through good literature, I suppose.
Yeah, whereas, so something like The Hobbit is brilliant. There's no fat on it. It's a very straightforward adventure story with a very like clear goal, which then gets achieved in like a roundabout way, and then, you know, it's all tied together very nicely. And what Tolkien does with that framework is just really fun and interesting, and it keeps you hooked, and it feels like you could keep digging in the fertile soil of that world and of that book for ages. And then you watch something like Avatar, and like you say, it just feels hollow.
Well, it's like poetry in a way. It's that you can read a very short... I mean, I'm not very poetic, and I'm also not very well read when it comes to poetry, but it's something I'm beginning to maybe be a bit more open to, is that you can have some very incredibly well-crafted half a dozen words. You know, a dozen words in a stanza or something, and what does that do? And you keep going back over it, and you find new meaning within it every time you reread it, or it comes up in a different circumstance and it has a connection and a resonance. Whereas when you just pile things in, and it's like, you know, more is not more. More is not better.
Yeah.
You know, but they keep adding, we want to do more. Bigger, make it louder, make it brighter. Yeah. Make it, you know, it's like, actually, you know what, just strip it back and just sit and listen to somebody telling the story, reading The Hobbit and using their voice. You'd probably have a more cinematic experience somebody doing that than all of the Peter Jackson films combined. Just listening to somebody as a storyteller, because there's more space for imagination there.
Yeah, and what's interesting, especially when you bring up, you know, poetry, that's just sparked a thought in me. My, as contrived as it is, and as obvious as it is, my favourite poem has always been "The Road Not Taken" by Robert Frost, which is this like very simple poem about a guy going for a walk in the woods, and he sees like two paths, and it becomes this like this brilliant like meditation on like almost the futility of choice. He's sitting there and he's trying to decide which path to take, and he goes, oh well, this one looks more in need of worn. Well, now that I look at it, they both look about the same. And it's about, you know, those choices. And then inevitably he just sort of takes a choice, and then it becomes about the reframing of that choice as something like that's good, as like, you know, oh, I made this choice because it was the, you know, the road less traveled and it was in need of wear. But in the end they were the same.
And good storytelling is you're trying to make sense of how, on what basis people made their choices. And sometimes it's as simple as, well, that was the only available option at the time. We didn't have any magical power that explained, we couldn't see ahead. You know, there's a thing you can do in literature is you can give people foresight.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, there is no foresight, not in daily life.
But it's
and we look at other people. I look at people all the time and think, you know, I wish I'd have worked this out earlier in my life. Had I known then what I know now, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you're looking at the narrative function of choices from afar, but you detach from it. But when somebody's narrative function and their choice-making approach is just, if you like, facile, then you just get disillusioned with it. It's like, well, it's just a series of events, and they just happen to skip through them.
Well, one of the things that the poem also shows is you can take something really simple, like somebody going for a walk, and make it into this huge, interesting thing that can sit and like prey on your mind for weeks. And then you contrast that to something like James Cameron's Avatar, which is huge, it's massive, it couldn't be any bigger in its scope. And it's ultimately this really facile and shallow, like, isn't whaling bad? Shouldn't we look after the environment, gang? Like, yeah, grow up.
I mean, he's aiming for a particular audience, isn't he? So, you know, compensate? And say, well, yeah, no, it's like, because people would look at comic books and say, well, you know, it's like, it's not really meant to be profound. I did, oh, by the way, because you talked about it, I did get to see The Batman. And I thought it was very good,
and much
better than the Christopher Nolan Batman. I thought it was much more interesting and presented the moral dilemmas and choices in a much more problematic way than any of the other films have done before. This kind of really presented, so, you know, somebody had a dilemma that they really had to make a choice about how they proceed and on what basis, and they had to find something within themselves to meet those challenges that they didn't think they had. I thought it was really good.
And you get the less glamorized version of, you know, what would somebody who decided to dress up as a bat and go and fight crime look like? And it turns out he would look like a greasy weirdo all alone in a dark and dusty mansion, not some sexy billionaire who's still, like, you know, playing that part. He's like, he becomes the reclusive billionaire whenever he steps out in public. People look at him and he's all like, you know, he's got the greasy hair and he's looking down.
And his voice, Robert Pattinson's vocalization was really interesting. It was like this whiny kind of, you know, he wasn't sophisticated or confident in any way. It was the opposite of that.
Yeah.
And yet he has this alter ego that turns into your vengeance. And I thought that was much more interesting. So I kind of finally caught up with it.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, whenever you take like any like genre or like medium as a whole, like there will always be like really good examples and really like mercenary examples that aren't very good. So like you can look at, if your only experience of cinema was to be something like Avatar, it's like, oh, this is what it is, it's this huge like spectacle, you probably leave a little bit like, well, not sure I'd go see anything. And the same with like comic books. If you read something like, I don't know, the latest crappy Avengers comic that they're releasing at the moment, you'd probably think, well, this is naff, isn't it? And then you get people that come along and they take like the art of storytelling a bit more seriously, and you get things that come out that are really a bit more interesting. Like, I don't know, what's a contemporary like the other side of the coin to Avatar 2, what's come out recently that's been really good. In the cinema? Good.
Yeah. I have no idea. There was very little that, you know, comes in my... I mean, maybe there is, but we don't... art cinema doesn't have the same...
I tell you what, in terms of, like, as well, because it's, like, an incredibly big... It's, like, a spectacle film, was Nope. When that came out, the new Jordan Peele movie, that was really, really, really good. To the point where it used the fact that it was spectacle to comment on the nature of spectacle itself. And then the whole film, in almost like a kind of Ouroboros-like way, is like eating its own tail. And it is this spectacle that comments on the nature and the damaging nature of spectacle, which then feeds into the spectacle more.
I was kind of put off. But maybe it was the yeah, I was put off from saying I haven't seen it yet. It's one of those ones where...
Brilliant.
All right, okay.
It's really brilliant.
It was filmed on IMAX, and I wonder, maybe I should have seen it at the cinema, but...
I mean, it was brilliant seeing it at the cinema, but I think you'd probably... You'd get it if you
did watch
it
Top Gun Maverick.
I didn't see it. I'm not watching it.
It was on Paramount Plus. I've got Paramount, so I could watch Star Trek, and it was on there.
Absolutely sick of military propaganda. Well, and I will not.
Well, Tom Cruise propaganda as well. It's very. But there is a thing. I did see a video on YouTube, and I thought this would, regardless of whether you think it's good for the storytelling process, but there's a video on YouTube that you can look at where Tom Cruise is doing a stunt in Norway. And it shows you the train and that goes into it. And what he does is he rides down this on a motorbike, and he's on there's a platform, like those skiing things, the people ski down, the ski jumpers go off, and he's riding down this thing, off the side of this thing, lets go of the motorbike and parachutes down to the ground. And he does that 6 times in the one day so they can get the right shot. He does it because he's trained to do skydiving and he's trained to do motorcycle riding. Mm. And I have to say, fair credit to the guy that he's done this and he's pushed it to the point where, it's not a stuntman doing it. It's not a digital face being put on him. He's actually done this. I mean, other than the point of spectacle, I'm like kind of, wow, that is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And to keep going back and doing it and improving it, it's like, wow.
It's one of the things I quite like about Tom Cruise is that, because when you watch those films as well, especially in contrast to like the Marvel movies, which are, they're all shot in warehouses in Detroit or whatever, amongst like green, everything's green and they're all wearing like dots, and that's the whole film. And then you get somebody like Tom Cruise who's willing to quite literally kill himself to give the audience something tangible to grasp onto. And I do think it adds another like qualitative layer to that experience of watching the film that is inherently more interesting.
What you're describing is Avatar is made entirely in that virtual studio and it misses the point of filmmaking. Somebody will come along and create the genre of storytelling, which comes through from electronic game and digital, entirely digital storytelling, animation, but it'll be in a new form. But it won't be from a filmmaking background. It'll be somebody else comes in. You don't need a James Cameron can't do that. And James Cameron would be well advised to go out with a camera and shoot in the streets again or climb a mountain or something stuff.
You know, when you sat there and you're watching it and so much of it is CGI, you wonder, well, do you know what? Why don't you then give up the pretense of this being a live action film? Why don't you instead animate it fully and then do something interesting with that animation? Get some like an interesting designer or stylist to do, instead of making it this photo realistic
we've done that with the Del Toro version of Pinocchio. People who invest, it's like Tim Burton's Corpse Bride. We use stop motion animation and they create something much more symbolically resonant that has much more meaning to it than all of the tricks and trickery that you bring in with a digital production.
It's a symptom of the larger lack of imagination that comes along with something like Avatar 2. Like Pinocchio's great because everything is, they've you can really see it as well. They've labored for years on these like these thing, these like little mini figurines to move around and to like physically like push around these little sets that they've made, and it feels more tangible and fun, because then there's like an exaggerated nature to the visuals where somebody's done and had like a very interesting vision, and like the demons and the goddesses and stuff that appear in Pinocchio, you look at them and you think, wow,
yeah,
that's like, it's interesting to look at. And then you look at Avatar and it's like
it's the equivalent of the mankind.
it's the difference. It's the difference between sitting down on Christmas Day and having a really delicious Christmas dinner cooked by your mum, and or, you know,
going to Kentucky Fried Chicken and sitting in a,
and somebody pooing in your chicken bucket. Like, that's the difference.
I saw a great meme the other day, which was it was Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, and it's a picture of Harry Potter working at Kentucky Fried Chicken and the Phoenix asking, I'd like a bucket of 12 pieces of chicken, please. I thought that was amazing. That was the best thing I've seen in ages. It just really just, you know, one thing, I think we've had a good moan about 22. We haven't got time to start talking about what we want to get out of 23, but I think the next time we meet up, we can maybe have a conversation about that. And that, I like that phrase, that, you know, that imaginative space is, what are we looking for? What are we thinking about in terms of that, you know, what that potential is? Because it's easy, and I do this, you get stuck in this sometimes, that mode of just moaning about stuff all the time. And it's like kind of in this part of my, you know, my DNA to just moan. And it's like, well, actually, it's more important to kind of go, no, let's put the time aside to do the work, to read the books, or to listen to the dramas, or to, you know, to engage in the content, the culture that actually does push aside, you know, it's you, as you say, you know, you can go to your local shopping center and you can walk around to TK Maxx and pound shops and, you know, all the rest of it if you want to, but you know what, we've got to make the effort to go and do something meaningful rather than just putting up with this crap.
It's sad, really, because I have read and done a lot of very interesting things over 2022, and I've read like probably more this year than I did the year before, and I keep reading more and more, and it's always interesting stuff and seeing interesting films. But it's also very fun to have a moan, and I really disliked Avatar 2. And
I didn't suspect it would take nearly an hour, though.
And I didn't. This is the first time I've got all of this out of my head, because when we were in the car in the cinema, on our way back, everybody enjoyed it, and I didn't want to be the one to sit there and say
it was rubbish.
What on earth are you talking about, you idiot? Like, I don't want to look to my mum and call her a dullard or something. Like, do you know what I mean?
The whole family went and saw this 3.5-hour movie.
They loved it, Rob. I suspect my dad was being a bit polite. I don't think he liked it as much.
Right.
But my mum liked it. My brother loved it. He went to see it twice.
Gosh. Mm. Well, on that note, so how can people get in contact with you?
They can't. It's Christmas. Don't bother.
Don't bother. If they want to follow your moans and grumbles, then you're on Twitter.
I am on Twitter at Clayton Comics with an X.
Great. And the website for this podcast is robwatsonmedia.net. And you can contact me on Twitter and Instagram at robwmedia. So hope you've had a lovely Christmas, and you're going to have a wonderful New Year. I thought I'd be trying to be upbeat and sincere.
On a good note.
And we'll meet up again to talk about things that we really think are going to be good for the coming year. And
we'll
set ourselves some challenges, because there are some things that we're going to be working on, I hope, to move things forward. Okay, speak to you soon. You've been listening to Distraction Therapy with me, Rob Watson. Find out more at robwatsonmedia.net, or follow me on Instagram and Twitter at robwmedia.